Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is British news journalist and music writer Ramzi Al-Wakeel. And we're talking about his new book, How We Used Saint Etienne to Live. Ramzi, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to be talking to you.
Thank you. Hello.
I got to tell you my reaction when I read that this book was coming out. As you wrote in your book very astutely, you know, Saint Etienne is one of those bands that is everyone's favorite secret. Like I thought, especially here in America now I realize, you know, that I was one of the few people who have been listening to them for a while.
Mm.
And then I saw this book was coming out about it and I was actually incredulous. So you got to tell me, what pushed you to write a book about them?
So, yeah, it's a good question. I'd written a book for the same publisher a few years ago about the Pet Shop Boys.
And I think I'd like to do an interview on that, but...
Okay. Another kind of, you know, maybe another band in the kind of favorite secret, maybe more in the U.S.
Oh, I think they're much more commercial than that. I mean, we see Pet Shop Boys videos here, and I think a lot of people know their songs. But this band is a special band.
It's a lot more niche. I've been, as you would have seen in the book, it's a band that I kind of discovered sort of by accident when I was quite young through a compilation album, one of the first albums I ever bought when I was 7 or 8 years old. Had this song, "He's on the Phone," was the song that was on it. It's the first Saint Etienne song that I ever heard, and I think they were. It was sort of their biggest hit in the UK, and it was not actually that big a hit. It was kind of just about big enough to sort of scrape onto the end of this kind of various artist album one of these sort of universal, sliding doors kind of moments. If it hadn't been on there, who knows? But it really kind of, I was just sort of hooked on it. And you know, when you're a kid, you kind of can't really explain what it is about certain songs that makes you just want to kind of keep coming back to them. But that was kind of it for about 15 years or so. And then, bizarrely, this sounds kind of made up, but this did in fact happen. I had a dream about them when I was at university about 15 years later. Because I guess I must have been thinking about, you know, my childhood or records I'd used to listen to or whatever it was. And I woke up and went, oh yeah, that band, I should really find out if, you know, the other songs are as good as that one that I knew. And so I bought one of their compilation albums, and the rest was kind of history really. But as far as writing the book goes, it was actually a slightly mundane answer, which is that after the first book I wrote came out, the publishers, I think, we're quite interested in getting something else out of me about pop music. And I was chatting to the guy who runs the publisher about Saint Etienne. I think he knows Bob Stanley personally.
Okay. Go.
Yeah, so the publisher, Repeater Books, is run by a guy called Tarek. I think he's also quite a Saint Etienne fan. He kind of... as far as I can tell, commissions books that he personally finds quite interesting, and that's kind of worked quite well for me. But we were chatting about this band, and he said, "Oh, you should write a book about these." And I kind of went, "Oh yeah, that sounds great. You know, I've been into them for years. That'll be really straightforward." And then, of course, as soon as somebody asks, "Could you write a book about something?" absolutely no idea what I was going to write about. I couldn't come up with, because I knew there was no point writing a sort of a conventional kind of rock biography.
I want to mention for the benefit of the audience, this is not that.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of, I guess, a book about what it's like growing up with music, and it's kind of uses Saint Etienne as a device to talk about that. It is a book about Saint Etienne, but it's
even a book about politics.
Yeah. I find it very hard to write books about music that don't start talking about housing at some point. I've done it twice.
That's
now,
right.
I really.
But it is a very personal take. At one point, you literally date your experiences with every release from Saint Etienne.
Yeah. I kind of, Yeah, I mean, I suppose essentially I've written, it's an autobiography and nobody really wants to read a book about me, do they? So I've sort of cheated a little bit by making it about something else. But there's a point in the book where I say I think this is a band that listeners who are sort of at all familiar with Saint Etienne, but also probably with other bands who are like this, will kind of recognise that there's a particular kind of fandom, I think, that they encourage, which is quite... So they encourage you, I think, to use their music to sort of catalogue your life, to sort of collect them.
Yeah.
Or, you know, people who are interested in kind of release dates and catalogue numbers and specific memories and, you know, or which pressing of this have you got and kind of bonus tracks.
Well, as you mentioned, and I didn't know, you know, first of all, imagine an American listener listening to Saint Etienne and then reading your book, realizing, whoa, have I missed like a lot? And one of the things that you talk about is they have so many releases that there are these obscure 13 of their full-length releases are limited or obscure. And that's like as much records that most bands get out ever.
Yeah.
So it's hard to be a completist of this band.
Absolutely. And I'm not. And even after writing a book about them, I know there's records that I haven't got, haven't heard even. But I think they're a band that wants people to do that. They kind of like the idea of being collected, I think, and they sort of like the idea of there being stuff that's out for different people at different times who happen to be in different places, so that you can almost use their career. This is something I talk about in the book. You can almost use their music to tell a different story depending on where you were and what you were doing with music at the time. And I guess that's true of all bands, but like,
well,
particularly much of this. Yeah,
I think after reading your book, I'm understanding that's a very particular thing for this band, to the point where they have compilation albums.
Yeah.
And talk about those, because those are very strange. They're essentially curated listenings.
Yeah, I think it's like they kind of... So one of the ideas I keep coming back to in this, and this is something that came out of interviews with Bob Stanley from the band, is although this is a band that appears to have a lot of influences from the past and to use the past in various different ways, they're quite anti-nostalgic and they don't like the word retro. They always want to be quite forward-looking, and I think part of that is it's not about denying that they have a long history. It's about seeing that history as something malleable, as not kind of a canon. You know, they're not a band that's going, this is our Abbey Road and this is like a,
right,
you know, this is a hallowed recording that, you know, is always going to be, you know, the best record of all time or any of this sort of thing. It's much more, okay, if we look at our past today through the point of view of, you know, ourselves at this point in our careers, what do we notice or what is an interesting story to tell about this? And so it's not so much that there is a definitive Saint Etienne history as there are lots of possible ones depending on how you look at it and where you were and sort of, you know, what time of day it is and all that sort of thing. So I think they've released kind of compilation albums that tell...
First of all, we should mention these are other people's music.
Yes.
And they've got really enigmatic names too, like 3 Day Week and English Weather.
Yeah, some of these are phrases that might be familiar if I wasn't, but if you know, if you were living through the 70s in Britain. So the 3 Day Week was as a result of oil shortages and general strikes. There was a period of time in Britain in the 1970s when basically they couldn't run the economy full time, and then basically what the members of the band have done with these compilation albums for this record label called Ace Records is they've chosen an idea which is kind of to some extent rooted in history. So one of those ideas might be the 3 Day Week. One of them might be, oh, what was it like when the 60s ended and nobody knew what was going to happen? One of them might be, oh, you know, what was it like to spend time in kind of in Germany in the mid 70s? What was it like to be in Paris during the spring of 68? And they'll take these sort of kind of ideas that really nobody, you know, they weren't there, we weren't there. And they'll go, what might like an imaginary soundtrack to these things sound like? So it's not so much that they're doing a work of historical archiving. They're doing something creative with history, which is kind of, in a sense, like an anti-historical impulse.
But, yeah, yeah.
But it's also perhaps, you know, actually in some ways more authentic, to be honest about the fact that, you know, look, we don't know what it was like, and two, actually everyone who was there would have had a different experience of it anyway. So isn't it more interesting to use that to create something new than it is just to kind of endlessly go, oh, this is the authentic thing. No, this is the authentic thing. Just to kind of iterate your way towards a sort of a singularity of, like, you know, one recording kind of thing. So I think, yeah, and I think they use that approach with their own music as well. They're very almost, I guess iconoclastic might be the word, I don't know.
Well, they use weird sampling in their music.
Yeah.
And you talk about that a lot in the book. You write a lot about it. I mean, they've sampled films, they've sampled TV things, they've sampled, and then they've just sort of done their own thing. But sampling's really important, but it's a weird thing. They're not looking at, again, you mentioned this before, it's not a nostalgic look at the past. It's a more of a subtle thing that they're doing with these sampling.
Yeah, I think there's almost, I mean, so in a lot of cases, they're sampling just stuff that they personally happen to like, that they've come across.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, favorite films or records that they like, or but I think
but it's stuff before they were born, which I find really fascinating, that they're especially films from like the sort of kitchen sink era of British films. I find that weird. I found it very interesting that they're doing that. They're sort of like imagining a past of England that they didn't participate in.
It's the same thing with the compilations. Yeah, the whole thing is really about treating history as a creative process rather than as a process of discovery. It's a process of invention. They will sample, in some cases, films that are to some extent classic films, but they'll sample them quite oddly. They'll take, you know, a quite inconsequential bit of dialogue or a noise that was heard. Or it's a low quality recording that's taken off a VHS that's taped off the television in the 80s. And so there's almost a kind of a denial of the like historical sort of supremacy of these things almost. It's like they're saying, oh, yeah, mate, you know, we're not beyond using classic things, but actually we're going to use them in a way that is, if not disrespectful, then is on our terms.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is British news journalist and music writer Ramzi Al-Wakeel, and we're talking about his new book. I hope this discussion gets you to listen to the band, How We Used Saint Etienne to Live. Okay, you know what we got to do, Ramzi? We've got to introduce the band, the personnel. Okay, Bob Stanley and Peter Wiggs. Where were they born? Where did they grow up? So let's introduce Peter Stanley, Peter Wiggs. They grew up in the outskirts of London?
Yeah, they're from... London is kind of almost made up of like 32 kind of smaller cities within it. And they grew up in this an area called Croydon, which is at the extreme south edge. So it's kind of almost not London.
Yep.
But it's connected quite well by trains to sort of, you know, the area further in. But yeah, they're from this kind of it's a suburb. Like it's quite sort of it went through a kind of a boom in the 60s, along, you know, the same time as the City of London sort of did as well. There was quite a lot of new modernistic sort of architecture and business moving to Croydon. So it was kind of like a centre outside the centre in a way, but it was definitely not central.
And Sarah Cracknell is very different. I mean, she grew up in a family that was pretty well of well-known parents.
Yeah, so her parents were Derek Cracknell, who was a quite well-known film director in the UK. He worked on, some James Bond films and Alien and things like that as a kind of an assistant director. I'll need to fact check that. I'm pretty sure that's correct. Her mother was an actress, Julie Samuel, who I think worked on. I'm trying to think what her big. There was something in the, I think, early 60s that she was quite big in, and then she kind of semi-retired, I think, when she had kids.
How did they at all get together?
The band. So Bob And Pete, who were the kind of the guys who'd grown up in Croydon, had moved to sort of central London, you know, more or less North London, and they were they'd originally planned to do this kind of dance music act with a different vocalist on every record.
Okay.
And actually, the first couple of songs they did have different vocalists. So the first three singles will have three different singers on them. And then they auditioned Sarah Cracknell. You know, from who we've just talked about, she auditioned for one of them, and then they went, oh, actually, this person's a perfect fit for us, so we're gonna hang on to her. And, it's funny how often that happens, actually. Yeah, there's more bands than Saint Etienne have been formed in the same way. But
well, and the other thing we have to talk about, especially to American audiences, they have nothing to do. They're not French.
And they're not French.
They named after a football club.
Yes, which is also nothing to do with them. So yeah, they're named after a football club that is named after a city in France that is named after a saint, and they're nothing to do with any of those things. I think they are football fans, and I think they were fans of the club Saint Etienne. there's this kind of the kind of question of, like, is there something French going on that sort of keeps returning?
And they'll sing in French sometimes.
Yeah, they'll sing in French. There's a couple of song titles in French. I think it's one. So one of the ideas I talk about in the book is the way that they create a sort of distance, or like an unknowability,
right.
Almost.
Right, right.
And so that kind of, like, slightly, although they're not French, and actually I think, you know, Bob was telling me that he doesn't even speak French well enough to have translated the sample at the start of their first album. So. He doesn't know what it's saying still. It's just somebody announcing a football match. But it's almost, I think there's something of the sense of what a French film is that they find kind of romantic and mysterious and interesting, even if they don't actually know what's going on in the film. So there's like they almost want to recreate some of that feeling of like alienness. Almost, I think.
They remind me in a subtle way of Godard and like something like Alphaville. I don't know why, but there's a coolness to their presentation that's fascinating. You talked about them and sex in the book, and you said that they're really not about sex. They're about the spaces before sex or around sex, pre-sexual.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to this same idea that there's almost... they're almost not in their own records in some cases. It's almost like they're kind of writing, they write around things and they write sort of the settings for things. But
right.
They're very, if you compare some of their lyrics to, you know, lyrics from perhaps more conventional pop bands, there's a lot less direct experiences of their lives in there. And one of the things I did briefly when I was writing the book was, this is sort of unscientific, but I ran all of their lyrics through a word counter because I'd noticed that they used words like I and me and you and your and those kinds of really crucial words for pop music, that they use them quite infrequently. And there are some songs, He's on the Phone is one of them,
right.
their biggest hit, that doesn't actually use the word I at all. And if you think about that in the tradition of pop music where it's all people talking about their own personal feelings, that's quite unusual. They use those words kind of probably half as often as a lot of other pop bands, was the sort of conclusion I came to. And so this sort of idea of, like, they're not really a band that talks about sex, or they do talk about sex, but in a very abstract kind of, from a distance way, almost through a window, talking about somebody else having sex rather than actually it being about their own romantic desires or any of that sort of thing. It's kind of in keeping with that. So it goes back to this idea of, you know, everything being a bit like a film, Frenchness and that sort of idea of distance and not quite being able to, they're not a band that tries to create the illusion that you're friends with them or that you're having a romantic relationship with them, which a lot of people do. They're very much a band that is, I don't know if aloof is the right word, but they're a long way away from you at all times, I think is the point.
It's a very cool attitude in the old definition of the word. It's a very cool, like at a distance, at an arm's length kind of attitude. There's so much to talk about. We're going to run out of time. I want to talk about filmmaking and the band.
Yeah.
the bands made films. That's something I never knew.
You should check them out, actually, if you're interested in London in particular.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're influenced. There's a 1967 movie you write about called The London Nobody Knows.
Yes.
And that's a band that resonates with them.
Yeah. So they, I think that was one of the films that they probably would have seen on television in the 80s. Because again, you know, really this is sort of when they were very small kids, this stuff was happening. But the film made by, what's his name, Jeffrey Fletcher, made this film called The London Nobody Knows. And it's kind of again, almost like an alternative look at London. So kind of a similar idea to what St. Etienne would then go on to do with their own work. They would have had films, you know, about London that were very focused on the kind of big, like, sort of tourist attractions.
Yeah, yeah.
And were almost promotional films for kind of, to local government, or, you know, trying to appeal to people to come and visit. And Jeffrey Fletcher made a film that was much more about kind of what London was really like, I suppose, you know, about sort of, he could visit slums, and he talks about sort of post-war destruction, and he goes to music halls that are about to be shut down, and it's almost about a version of London that's in the process of disappearing.
Right.
And I think this kind of sort of alternative history idea really resonated with St. Etienne because I suppose it goes back to this idea that they don't like the idea that there are things that are sacrosanct. They don't like kind of the idea of a canon. They don't like being respectful to things just for the sake of it. So I think they kind of took this idea of what if we made a slightly almost tongue-in-cheek, but certainly more kind of, you know, honest sort of warts and all portrait of not of London as a whole, but of a particular aspect of London at a particular time. And so you can watch these films back, and there's one they made sort of 21 years ago, I think, which is, again, actually a lot of London is being demolished at that point. It's sort of start of the 2000s, the kind of new Labour era, there's a new mayor, it's quite a sort of period of change. There's one they made a few years later about the site on which the Olympic Games
Right.
village was
right.
then built. And again, it's about sort of bits of London that are disappearing almost. So they've got this kind of, alongside their music, there's this this sort of parallel career of documenting bits of London as they go. But there's always a slight sense of you don't quite know how much of it is fictionalized, or at least has a kind of a sort of a narrative kind of gloss put over it, because it's all very, again, it has this kind of style where it's very kind of removed and feels quite inaccessible and a bit cool. So
is one of the film titles I've been trying to tell you?
Yeah, so actually that's their newest album came with a film. Both had that title. That one's a bit different, actually. It's so that was made by what was the guy's name who made it? I've completely forgotten.
Well, don't worry about it.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so that's much more of a, it's still got the strangeness and the lack of kind of, you know, there's almost no dialogue in the film. It's all kind of set to their music, and it's very sample-driven music, and there's not really many lyrics, but it has much more of a narrative line, and is more kind of, I guess, fiction in a sense than the other films are. It sort of follows this kind of group of young people in London and going on a trip to the countryside and going swimming, and, you know, not a lot happens, but it's a portrait of a particular feeling, I think, more than it is actually a portrait of a place, which is what the other films are.
I just want to mention a bunch of things before, because we're going to run out of time. We've got 5 minutes left.
Yeah.
Did they release the album Home Counties on cassette?
They did.
That's long after cassettes were popular.
Absolutely, yeah, but about 30 years too late. I think, so the kind of theory I have in this book is that Home Counties was an album, you know, people won't necessarily be familiar with it, but it was an album that came out in 2017, and the imagery and a lot of the songwriting was kind of inspired by almost like fake images of Britain.
Yep.
And there was this kind of period of time. It was sort of immediately after the Brexit referendum had taken place, when kind of, to be honest, both sides of the referendum had constructed almost kind of, you know, very PR-led kind of artificial visions of, on the one hand, Britain, on the other hand, the European Union. and you know, it was all kind of like glossy, like high contrast photographs of sort of houses in suburbia, and the songs were kind of almost these sort of little kitchen sink dramas about people. And so I think there was, I don't know, I mean, one of the things they did on the artwork was they had all these like fake like hype stickers, like you put sort of hype stickers on album covers, you know, with sort of prices on and sort of what tracks are included. But they went to town, and there were like 15 of them or something on this album cover. You know, and they also have ridiculous things like, you know, I don't know, one of them said skilled musicians with 25 years experience, and it's all this sort of thing. And so I think, you know, maybe there was a calculation that that cassettes were now kind of a niche collectible again, but I think it was sort of appropriate that they ended up going back to this sort of quite almost like nostalgia for the sake of nostalgia format to reflect an album that was about fake visions of the past and sort of making up a version of the past that was more glossy than it really had been.
Okay, we're out of time. Now here's one last question. For people, for American audiences, for people who have never heard the band before, if they want to start listening, what album would you recommend?
It's a tough one because they haven't got this kind of canon.
Yeah, I know that. I knew it was a tough question. What's the first thing that springs into your mind? What album?
I would say listen to Tiger Bay.
Okay, all right.
Not my favorite, but it has kind of a couple of the biggest hits on. It's got a real breadth, so it's quite, parts of it are quite folky and quite pastoral. It's got like orchestras on it, but then there's some quite hard sort of electronic sounds on it as well, and some just really great choruses and some really beautiful singing. So I think it's a good kind of everything in one package. I would say that's the one to start with.
Okay, we'll end it there. We could be talking about this band for hours, and that's the way the book reads too. I love the way the book reads. One of my favorite quotes is, "They're a neurotic novel found in a museum bookshop that you can't read because it's in Portuguese." That's what this band means to my guest tonight, Ramzi Al-Wakeel. He's a British news journalist and music writer, and we're talking about his new book. I really enjoyed it. How We Used Saint-Étienne to Live. Ramzi, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark. Cheers.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.